From KCBW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Since the end of the 16th century, Western audiences have been seduced by opera. Maybe it's the elaborate costuming, maybe the scenery, the drama, the spectacle of it all that continues to draw fans. Or maybe it's just the voices that soar with control and passion. Opera may seem like an unlikely element in a parade, but that's just what some opera students will bring to this year's Days of 47 festivities, and that's giving us a chance to talk about opera, the enduring appeal, and the celebration of the voice. Plus, a musical with a message heads to the Big Apple. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Utah's pioneer ancestors loved music of all kinds, but especially opera. The Salt Lake Opera Company started in 1879. The Walker Opera House is said to have rivaled the city's main performance space, the Salt Lake Theater, until it burned down in 1891. And today's opera students are honoring that early legacy by singing excerpts of Carmen in Utah's largest parade next week. That's giving us an opportunity to reflect on opera's enduring appeal, on the technique, what makes the opera voice, and how opera transcends time and culture. Joining me in studio is Ariel Bybee. She's an adjunct professor of voice at the University of Utah, also co-chair of Friends of Opera with her husband. She sang more than 450 performances with the Metropolitan Opera in New York City, a prominent mezzo-soprano for 18 seasons, and a seasoned teacher. And Ariel Bybee, it's great to have you in studio. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. We love talking about opera.
Of course. I'm glad to hear it. Also with us, Daniel Tutow. He's a doctoral student in vocal performance and a baritone with the Graduate Vocal Quartet at the University of Utah. He has recently performed Mozart's Don Giovanni and Carlisle Floyd's Susanna. And Daniel, great to have you in studio as well.
Yeah, it's exciting. We're excited to be here.
And Demaree Brown, she's another doctoral student in the vocal performance program at the University of Utah, a mezzo-soprano, also with the Graduate Vocal Quartet. And she's also an experienced choir teacher. Demaree, great to have you in studio as well. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Later on in the program, we'll switch to another musical expression. We'll hear about a local production that's making it in the Big Apple. But first, opera. What do you like about opera, or what do you admire about opera singers? Give us a call if you have questions or comments about your favorite production or about technique. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Ariel Bybee, I want to start with you. You've had a very distinguished career as a performer, singing in New York City and San Francisco, but I understand you started your career as a junior high school music teacher.
Right here in Salt Lake City.
Yeah. Describe how you made that transition from junior high teacher to diva.
You know, it's actually a pretty natural one. I was teaching school here and auditioned for some of the major programs here, the San Francisco auditions, the Met auditions, and it was Marisa Bravanel who actually came to me and asked me if I would sing in his program called the Music Academy of the West in Santa Barbara, California. And he was a real mentor to me for many, many years and gave me many wonderful opportunities to sing. I actually sang at the U before Utah Opera was established under Ardeen Watts. I sang several operas there. So I really got my start here in Salt Lake.
Were there lessons that you took from your junior high experience to the stage? Transition points that really helped you out?
Teaching is not far from performing in an opera. You know, there are a lot of similarities. I think Demaree can tell you that as a teacher herself. You know, you're in front of the students. You could call them an audience in a lot of ways, and you have to be on. You have to be ready all the time, and you are often singing with them. I've always enjoyed performing. And when I have an audience in front of me, whether it's a bunch of junior high school students, you know, or some real opera aficionados, it's really just wonderful to perform. Opera is a complex art form. And not only are we just singing, we're not standing there singing. We're in costume and makeup. And we're a character in a play, and it's all fun. I put on opera productions while I was here at Churchill Junior High School, and we put on some Gilbert and Sullivan, some little shows nobody's ever heard of, but it was so much fun to be the director and producer of those shows, which gave me a start in doing that kind of thing also.
Mm. Describe your first starring role.
Oh my goodness. Gee, can I even remember what that was? I'll tell you, one of my, I really began singing in San Francisco, and it wasn't a starring role at the beginning, but the first major role I sang in San Francisco was Carmen. And I had actually sung Carmen as a student at BYU. Years before. So that was a treat for me to go back as a professional and be able to have had the experience of singing that. And that's the kind of experience university can give you to prepare you for that professional career. So then I was able to sing that in San Francisco, and it was just an incredible experience. You know, it was all of the things I'm talking about. You know, it was wonderful singing. The characters exciting. You know, the production was wonderful. The orchestra was great, because opera is the most complex art form there is, and to participate in all the elements of it is so exciting an art form.
I understand that in earlier in your career, you had to replace another mezzo-soprano on a very short notice.
Yes.
Teresa Stratus, I
yes.
believe is her name. What happened?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I was what they call at the Met a cover for the part of Jenny in Mahagoni, a Kurt Weill opera. And it was the Saturday broadcast, the first performance of that opera that season. And Teresa Stratus, who was a notorious canceler, she canceled. So, I didn't find out she was canceling until the very mornings of the Saturday broadcast.
How did you react? How do you prepare for something like that?
Ahead of time. I'd been preparing for that. Fortunately, I had sung the part of Jenny before in San Francisco. So a lot of the experience that I had in San Francisco prepared me for my my debut and a lot of the things I did at the Met.
And you got critical acclaim for that. I was digging through some old reviews, exuberance and,
wow.
you know, presentation. I mean, people were very flattering of your performance in that role.
They were. After I had sang that performance, I was in backstage at the Met, and Placido Domingo came up to me and he said, "You were sensational, but that's a no-lose situation, because people, when you come in as a cover, people are on your side. They want to see you do well." And I don't even remember that first performance on the radio, because I was in some other realm. You know, it was just all woo. You know, what's going on here? But it was a wonderful experience. And then, of course, Teresa was sick for the rest of the season, so I got to do all the rest of the performances. That was a wonderful experience. It's a great opera if you haven't heard it. Kurt Weill, wonderful. I really love him as a composer.
Speaking with Ariel Bybee, she's an adjunct professor of voice at the University of Utah, saying many performances with many opera companies, including the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. Also with us, Daniel Tutow, a doctoral student at the University of Utah, and Demaree Brown, another doctoral student in vocal performance. And they are going to be performing in a kind of a slightly unique venue at the Days of 47 parade next week. We'll talk about that in a moment. But if you'd like to join us, we're talking opera this morning. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Daniel, let's bring you into the conversation. You know, we live in this age of rock and roll and pop divas, American Idol.
Mm-hmm.
What was the appeal of opera for a young man like you?
Well, I just like to sing, basically. And you know, in when I was a kid, it was in a children's choir. When I got to high school, it was musical theater. When I got to college, it was opera. And so, you know, there's just a lot of opportunities in this field because it's, I guess it's not as popular in a lot of the younger crowd. So there's a lot of openings. And it's true in actually almost all art forms is that the girls way outnumber the guys.
Good odds for you.
The odds are, my sex is actually the best asset I have because there's usually twice as many guy parts for half as many guys auditioning. So, you know, the more I sing this form, the more amazing it seems. You know, it's an educated art form in the sense that, you know, your average Joe on the street doesn't usually get it because it's in a different language a lot of the time. The musical sort of idioms, the sort of the way it's presented is not sort of what we consider popular now. And so the more you understand it, the more you get to understand, wow, this is really, you know, it's really amazing. There's these deep stories going on. You understand what the music is telling you. And it's just been a sort of a learning experience as I've been going on since I got into college is when I started exploring this world of opera. Of course, I get everyone asking me, oh, is she going to audition for American Idol? Maybe not. That's exactly not my cup of tea, but... But singing is basically just been the door to opening a lot of different opportunities for me. Mm.
Demarie, what about for you? What's the appeal of opera? Did you find that this was a passion, a love from a young age, or did you sort of grow into it, kind of develop it?
It was a little bit of both. When I started singing classically, I loved to sing. I loved the strength that comes behind operatic singing, but I didn't really like to listen to opera itself. And as I continued my education and understood more about these operas and these stories and how the music works, I grew to love it. And as a young girl, actually, we lived on the East Coast, and my mother had actually met Ariel Bybee and had told me about her all growing up, and this famous Mormon opera singer she just introduced her to me. And I started studying with Ariel about almost 8 years ago, and since then I have really grown to love singing opera.
So would you say it's an acquired taste in some ways?
In some ways, yes. I think some people are born with this love for opera, and some people have to be educated.
And I think a lot depends on what types of opera you're first introduced to. There are some that are less sort of connecting to what we have going on now. There's, you know, more sort of, I guess you'd call them esoteric operas, like ones that aren't performed very often. And if that's your first experience with opera, you might be like, it's not for me. But there's, you know, a lot of operas that I feel are kind of universal. Some of them, like Carmen, that we'll be doing excerpts from, is one that just music just kind of moves you. And, you know, even if you don't understand the words, you still get a feeling of the excitement of the performance. So I think some of it, a lot depends on how you're first introduced to opera as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you mentioned it, Carmen, before we hear from you, Daniel, I want to give listeners, we've already got 19 minutes without some opera. We need to hear some opera. Daniel's kind enough to sing a little bit of the Toreador song from Carmen. But Ariel Bybee, do you want to set it up? I mean, what is it about Carmen that has just, you know, enraptured audiences for decades?
Sometimes people kid about opera stories. You know, they say they're silly or they don't make sense. And in many cases, that's true. But opera is one of, Carmen is one of the great operas because of all of its elements. And number one is its story. It's a very strong story. And it is the character of the tenor, Don José, that really makes it a great story because he changes from a soldier, a very strong soldier, and this, a gypsy girl, gets a hold of him. And throughout the course of the opera, he becomes crazy, really. He's so crazy about her, in the end, he actually kills her. He becomes a nothing. He leaves service and he leaves his sweet girlfriend. Carmen obsesses him and he becomes nothing, a total failure. And it's sad, but it's very exciting. And of course, Bizet's music is incredible. The orchestrations are incredible. The setting of Seville is incredible. And, you know, the gypsy life has something of intrigue in it. And I don't know, can you guys think of anything else? It's just a perfect opera.
High drama. Lots of action going on. Tell us about the Toreador song, Daniel.
So yeah, Don José is one of the main character that you see his transformation, and he's a tenor, and I'm a baritone, so I'm not seeing any of his parts. But the Toreador song is another character that's introduced, who's the Toreador Escamillo, and this song is sort of one of the atypical, we need an opera song, put this in, and sort of everyone knows the chorus part because it's the same word for half of it, which is the Toreador. He's a bullfighter, and he's comparing the life of a bullfighter to the life of a soldier and how they both have the same sort of excitement of fighting and blood and women, which is, of course, the main thing of most operas surrounding them. So, and the word Toreador is the word matador, you know, the bullfighter translated, and so.
Okay, well, let's hear a snippet. This is Daniel Tutau singing the Toreador song from Carmen, and I'm going to have you scoot back a little bit. All right.
Toreador en garde, Toreador, Toreador. Et songe bien, oui, songe en combattant, que ne noir te regarde, et que l'amour t'attend, Toreador, l'amour, l'amour t'entend.
Oh, that's beautiful! Nothing like an aria to get you going in the morning. That's Daniel Tutau. He is a doctoral student at the University of Utah, also with us Demarie Brown, another doctoral student in vocal performance, and adjunct professor Ariel Bybee, an accomplished and acclaimed mezzo-soprano, talking about opera, which these two students will be singing in the Days of 47 parade next week. If you'd like to join us, if you've got a favorite opera, if you want to know about, you know, why it appeals to you, its place in the performing arts, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Aida, The Marriage of Figaro, La Traviata. You may not recall the words or the titles, but chances are you can recall some of the tunes. Luciano Pavarotti, of course. Today on the program, we're talking about opera, why the art form continues to gain fans, and how it's changing. Joining me in studio is Ariel Bybee. She's an adjunct professor of voice at the University of Utah, also an acclaimed mezzo-soprano in her own right. And two graduate students are with us, Daniel Tutau. He is a baritone, and Demarie Brown, a mezzo-soprano. They will be singing on a carriage in the Days of 47 parade next week. And that's why we're talking about opera, because it's an interesting topic. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. If you've got a favorite opera moment or memory, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is that number. Demarie, you're a teacher yourself.
Yes.
When we hear, and you said that you were drawn to be drawn to classical training. Describe exactly what that is. What does it mean when people say, I am classically trained? You know, I'm training my voice in a classical way.
There's several types of, well, a few types of singing going on right now, and that's classical singing and, of course, pop singing and music theater. When you're classically trained, you are able to sing on a stage without the use of amplification. Your voice is the amplifier. And I think that's the huge difference between music theater and pop singing, is that we don't need microphones on the stage. So we use in a sense, more muscle power, I guess, when we sing. So it's a controlled use of vibrato, and it's just a stronger form of singing. I think it's, you have opera, then music theater, then pop and folk singing and things like that. But it's definitely at the top of the list in terms of strength and power.
Ariel, Bybee, I want you to sing just a couple of bars from the Habanera from Carmen. But I'm curious, like, physically, what is happening in your body when you prepare yourself? Your jaw, your diaphragm, I don't know what happens, but...
Well, I think, first of all, what we have to say is that you have to have talent to be an opera singer. In some cases, you're actually born to opera. I know I did not choose opera myself. It really chose me. I had a big voice. Every time I sang, people would cover their ears, you know, and say, oh, wow. But Demery's absolutely right. We have to sing without a microphone. And some people have to learn that skill. Other people have it. They have these big voices. And I find that those are the people who are drawn to opera. They just naturally say, well, because if I try to sing a pop song, it sounds terrible, you know. But, you know, I can sing very soft, a lullaby to my grandchildren. But if I sing what I call in a legitimate way, I must learn to expand my voice. And, of course, that means use my body. My body is an instrument. Singing is a very athletic event.
Well, do you want to give us a demonstration?
Demonstration? You mean by singing a little bit?
Yes.
Well,
please.
You know, the idea of singing today came up, and I thought, oh my goodness, it's 9 o'clock in the morning.
I know. It's unreasonable.
Opera singers are notorious about wanting to prepare, but you see why? Because it's so physical. The body has to be so ready. I mean, I always say, oh, let me warm up a half hour. Let me take 2 throat lozenges first, 5 glasses of water. I've got to say a prayer, and I've got to rub my rabbit's foot, you know, and all these things. And then maybe I'm ready to sing a little bit. But, you know, whatever. I haven't got anything to lose at this point in my career. You know, people say you're only as good as your last note. Well, I gave that up long ago.
Again, you're used to not singing with the microphone. So
that's right.
Step back.
That's right.
So
I'll really get back here.
Okay.
All right.
This is Ariel Bybee.
And then it goes into La
Mor. Oh, bravo.
You know, I needed an orchestra.
Wish we could have provided one. That's the incomparable Ariel Bybee singing La Habanera for us this morning. If you'd like to join us, we're talking opera this morning. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones. David's been holding for Murray. David, hi.
Hi. Bravo. That was great. My question was, I saw a movie called Excalibur a long time ago, and it was, I'll never forget, it had opera at one of the best parts of the movie was accompanied by opera, and I gotta say, it was very powerful, and I wondered if you had... what you thought opera had a role in cinema in the near future. And I just think that the two mediums together are extremely powerful, and I just wondered what you had to say about that.
Interesting question. David, thanks very much for the call. And it's interesting that you actually have some experience in this field, Ariel Bybee. I understand that you did the voice in La Traviata, in Zeffirelli's screen adaptation of the opera. What to David's question, I mean, what role do you think opera has in cinema, in film?
I think many directors use opera in films. You often hear it as background music. I don't know if I can think of an example right now. Can you, you guys?
Shawshank Redemption?
Oh, yes, wonderfully. And The Room with a View is one I always remember. Oh, my goodness, the beautiful music in that. Yeah. And I think there are many others.
I don't know. Does it translate well to the film?
I think absolutely. Yeah, you know, you get that wonderful sound kind of washing over you in the theater. And what's the other movie? Oh, I'm coming up with lots of them, but you know, it would take me a minute to come up with the names of them.
That's
yeah,
all right.
The one with Tom Hanks. Yeah, but sometimes opera plays an active part in the movie, but often it's background music, and sometimes we don't even know what it is, but we'll recognize a tune or something like that. But I don't remember Excalibur. I've probably seen it. I'm a huge movie fan, but I think opera has a very strong place in movies.
Yeah, I feel the composers knew emotions. And when, you know, when they wrote, even if they wrote 100 years ago, 200 years ago, they knew that these groups of chords, this movement, this motion, this rhythm would create these certain feelings in people. And directors now know that they can utilize those same, taking a Wagner opera, taking a Mozart opera, taking those excerpts that really move people on the, you know, despite language, just the sound of the music, and try to use that in their films now. So I think it's extremely relevant now as it was, you know, when it was written 100 years ago or 20, 50, however long ago.
Mm-hmm. David, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. We're speaking with Ariel Bybee and two graduate students in vocal performance at the University of Utah, Daniel Tutow and Demery Brown. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is that number. And let's go to Kevin in Salt Lake City. Kevin, hi.
Hello. Hey, I wanted to ask your guest. I'm not much of a singer, except maybe in the shower. And I've always been impressed with the how opera singers can really sing with such incredible power and force. And I kind of wanted to ask the guests how they did that.
Okay. Well, this goes back to that technique. Ariel, you said, you know, something you have to be born with to some extent. But can you develop that power, that force that Kevin is talking about?
Absolutely. Singing is an athletic event. You, through exercise and vocal exercises, can develop strength and muscle and breath. All
can
plays
you give
a
us
part
a quick lesson? What are some of the techniques that you do to develop the breath control or the volume?
You know, that's a controversial question right there, because there are so many different ways of teaching voice. So many teachers have their own technique and approach. Some of them have students lie on the floor. Some of them have them rub, tires around their stomachs. Some of them have that lift chairs while they're singing. Others have them push on the piano. All kinds of things to learn to develop strength in the voice. And what we're talking about is the movement of breath, and then controlling that breath, and then singing is very much like shouting. How do you shout? And you have to learn to sing in an extended shout on a pitch, and create the tone with what we call an open throat. And all of these things take years to develop. What do you guys think as students?
Demery, what do you think?
I think it's all about, you know, when it's all about controlling the registers of the voice. You have a head voice and you have a chest voice, and young children learn how to sing in this light head voice, you know, but there's no strength in that. And eventually, if you learn how to combine those two registers using the chest voice, like the speaking voice that I'm using now, I think that really helps control the voice, and it helps give it that strength as well.
Could you do me a favor? You're going to be singing Segedia in the Days of 47. Could you do a compare and contrast kind of thing, one with the one kind of voice that you just mentioned and one with the operatic voice?
So if I were to take out the chest voice, I would sing Predera pardus evia. And that's lacking the strength. But if I were to add more chest voice, Predera pardus evia.
There's a qualitative difference.
Right. So it's learning how to combine those two voices, at least the technique that I use, and amplify the voice that way.
Okay, Kevin, keep singing in the shower. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Speaking with Ariel Bybee, the acclaimed mezzo-soprano who performed hundreds of times with the Metropolitan Opera and other companies around the country. Also, Daniel Tutow, a doctoral student in vocal performance at the University of Utah, and Demaree Brown, who you just heard a beautiful mezzo from the University of Utah. They will be singing in the Days of 47 parade next week. And I guess, Ariel, why is opera being featured in this year's Pioneer Day parade? It seems kind of odd.
Well, yes, it actually is kind of odd. And I think what we wanted to do here, we have a lovely friend who is on an organization we just developed at the university called the Friends of Opera. And our goal is to create visibility in the community and to raise opera to a new level at the university. And so to gain this visibility and to share the talents of all the wonderful talent we have with you, we wanted to put that on display this year in the parade. So our wonderful friend, who is a member of the advisory board of Friends of Opera at the U, has loaned us one of the 15 carriages she owns. And we went over to her storage unit where she has all her carriages and tried out which of the carriages would be most appropriate to sing on. And so we decided we wanted to have three or four singers. We wanted as many to show off how many wonderful singers we have at you, but obviously we could only get two on the carriage. And so they're gonna be Carmen and the Toreador, and they're going to sing their main arias all along the parade route. We're very excited about that. So our sponsor is Friends of Opera, and I think the public's going to be very impressed with the level of education our students are getting, opera education at the U.
Prior in our conversation, Ariel mentioned that opera is more than just singing, getting up and doing a solo. It's very theatrical. There's costumes and scenery. Will you be dressing up in a special way in the Days of 47, Daniel Tutow?
Oh, yeah. You got. I put together a whole Matador costume. It's going to be awesome.
Nice.
Nice. And Demaree looks great. She has a great Carmen dress that actually Ariel wore.
Yes, I'm loaning it to her.
Yes, terrific. I mean, is that part of the appeal of opera for you as well? It's just, you know, this stage presence. And did you take acting lessons in addition to voice lessons, Demaree?
Not really, no. All the acting lessons that I've received have come through my education in opera performance and through Ariel, who is a fabulous actress. Oh. She's really pushed it into me. And also through being a teacher. We have to entertain these kids and we have to teach them. And so I've learned to get on the floor and play and things like that. But I think the costume really helps us on the stage because it makes me feel like I am the character. Helps me act even better, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is acting part of your training, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, I've done a lot of straight play as well without any music in there and musical theater and those types of things as well. So, yeah, acting becomes a huge part. I had family come and see the most recent production we did at the U, the Susanna production in April, and they were surprised at how much acting had to go on the stage. They came to an opera, they expected to see, you know, people just singing, but it was, you know, it's this whole other world that has to be created. And yeah, the costume is usually a huge part. It's always great. And I don't think we'll be wearing any because it'll be probably pretty hot. But putting on makeup as well is one of those things that kind of helps transport you into this whole other different person that you can portray.
And Ariel, you mentioned that you are in the zone when you were performing. You didn't even remember consciously what was going on. I mean, that sounds a lot like the actor's craft.
Yes, absolutely. You have to delve very deep into the character you're portraying, and in an effort to become that person, you lose self, and especially with the addition of the singing, the concentration level is just so high when you have the combination of the singing and the acting together. You know, singing is hard. So opera singing is very difficult. And when you combine all of these talents into one performance, it's a very high standard, a very high level of art.
Why has it endured? I mean, and what's the outlook for opera going into the future, to the next generation? You know, how do you continue to appeal to audiences who are a little more accustomed to the pop sound, or, you know, just scrolling down all of the top of the charts on iTunes? You know what I mean?
Definitely.
I mean, how do you bring in that next generation and introduce them to your love of opera, Ariel Bibi?
Yes, this is a very good question. Opera, in some ways, has become a museum piece. I myself love museums, so I love it being a museum piece. But in order for it to be viable today, there are a lot of wonderful composers in every country, but I would say in particularly America, who are creating new operas in English that young people can understand, operas with modern musical sounds that young people can relate to. But in my opinion, opera is always going to be a selective art form that never are as many people who as like rock and want to go to rock concerts. It's never going to be as popular as that. But it will always survive, I believe, because it's a great art form. Just like symphony will always exist because it's great. It's just great music. Opera, for the most part, is a very high level of music. So maybe fewer people will be drawn to it, but I believe it will exist, and there will always be people like me who will be singers, because opera selects you. That is the kind of voice you were born with and raised to have in your life. So there will always be opera singers, and there will always be young people like these young talented people who are drawn to it and want to be well educated and want to learn to be great singers. So for those reasons. And we have people like Peter Gelb at the Met, who are creating operas where he insists that the performers can not only sing well, but that they act well and they look well on stage. And this is modern opera when you get all of those things. You know, way back in the golden days of opera, people who weighed 300 pounds would go on stage and
sing.
The fat lady sings with her horns and the whole thing, and just stand there and make a big sound, and everybody would say bravo. It doesn't happen that way anymore. So opera is, in that sense, becoming updated.
Mm. Ariel Bibi, she's an adjunct professor of voice at the University of Utah, an acclaimed mezzo-soprano who performed many, many times with the Metropolitan Opera and other companies around the country and around the world. Ariel Bibi, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Also, Daniel Tutow, a graduate student in vocal performance at the University of Utah and a baritone, and Demaree Brown, another doctoral student, a mezzo-soprano with the University of Utah. They will both be singing in the Days of 47 parade next Tuesday. Daniel and Demaree, thanks so much for your time as well.
Yes, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Coming up next, another variation on our musical theme today, a new production of Shelter. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. A production of a full-length dramatic musical written by two Utahns is headed to the Big Apple. Shelter, written by Brittany Bolin, who also composed music with her brother-in-law, Newell Bolin, premiered last year at the historic Murray Theater. It will be part of this year's prestigious New York Musical Theater Festival for a 6-performance run. And today on the program, we're learning more about this pop rock musical about love, loss, and starting over. Joining me in studio is Brighton Sloan. She is the director and producer and founder of Spotlight Theater Company. Brighton, good morning. Thanks so much for your time.
Hi, thanks.
Also with us, Brittany Bulland, the writer of Shelter. She's also a composer and an actress. She wrote the music and lyrics for Shelter. She will play Gloria in this production that's headed to the New York Musical Theater Festival. And Brittany, good morning to you.
Good morning.
If you've got questions or comments about Shelter, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Brittany Bulland, as the writer, we'll get into some specifics, but give us a general sense. What is this play about?
The play follows a woman named Janine as she comes to work at a women's shelter in Philadelphia. It's about her experience there and how the women that she meets and the experiences that she has connected to the shelter help her to move on from a difficult past.
Mm. What got you thinking about the shelter as a place where there are a lot of stories, there's a lot of drama, heartache, victories? I mean, what made you think that the shelter was where you wanted to focus on in your play?
Actually, the idea came from Brighton. We were talking one day, we had done a show together, and we were talking about how she was always looking for musicals to produce that had lots of roles for women, because as you probably know, there are always plenty of women who want to do musicals, not so many men. I had experimented with writing musicals in the past, and I just kind of started brainstorming what a musical for women would look like, and the idea of a women's shelter came up, and it just kind of went from there.
What was the appeal for you, Brighton, to take on this project?
Well, I think it's a very timely issue, and the thing I like about the script is it takes the we tend to think of homelessness in a very broad sense, that there's the homelessness issue. And I think what Shelter tries to do is to put a face on different cases of homelessness and say these are the kinds of people that wouldn't find themselves in the situation, and has sort of a theme that change doesn't come as a big social movement. It's not a giant shift in society, but it's individual actions for individual people and individual stories. And that's what I hope the audience is able to take away from Shelter.
Mm. Why set this in Philadelphia? And why a musical, actually?
Well, that's an interesting question. Yes, a set of interesting questions. Why set it in Philadelphia? I couldn't tell you.
An honest answer. I love it.
I don't know. I don't remember. But why a musical? I guess the only way I can really answer that is just to say that I love musicals. Musicals are my favorite form of artistic expression, and I've been a musical theater nerd ever since I was a little kid. And so I think sometimes musicals are the most fun way to tell a story, because sometimes the things that people feel are so big that to try to act them almost seems insufficient. I think sometimes, particularly in a situation like this, where you got a bunch of women who are in very, very extreme emotional circumstances and going through some really, really big, big things, I think sometimes music is almost the most appropriate way to express those feelings.
Speaking with Brittany Bulland, she's the writer of the production Shelter. She's also a co-composer, I guess, is that what I call you, and
yes,
an actress. And Brighton Sloan is the director and producer of this production. She's also the founder of Spotlight Theater Company. And Shelter will be staged next Thursday, July 26th through Sunday the 29th at the PTC Performance Space, 555 West 42nd Street in New York City, as part of the 2012 New York Musical Theater Festival. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Brighton Sloan, how did this wind up in the New York Musical Theater Festival? Very prestigious group, an annual gathering. How did this happen?
Well, Brittany submitted the script last year after we had completed our last production. We found out in January, somewhere around there, that we were being considered as finalists, and we didn't finally hear the confirmation that we'd been accepted the festival until May, so it didn't give us a lot of time to get ready.
How did you react to it?
I was just shocked. I'm not shocked in the sense that I feel like Brittany has really strong work and it deserves to go somewhere, but it just, finally you start hearing the title Off-Broadway Show, and it's going to this festival, it's the equivalent of the Sundance Festival, and I'm just graduated from college, and to have Brittany be so kind as to offer me an opportunity to direct it was really unexpected for me.
Brittany, is this your first play? I mean, as a playwright, as a musical?
It's my first musical, yes. Yes, I almost attempted to write a musical in college, but unfortunately they wiped the computers, so there's no evidence that it ever existed. So technically, yes, this is my first actual musical. Second play, but first musical. Well, a third play.
A number, a handful.
Yes.
But to hit the big time on, you know, one of your first productions, that's got to be, you know, big.
It is big. It's big. I'm still trying to process that.
Let's hear a piece. This is a piece from the musical Shelter titled Endless Line. Before we hear it, do you want to set it up?
The endless line is kind of a recurring motif in the show. It kind of creates that sensation of living day in and day out, this really dreary, drudging lifestyle with no place to go, and how they feel very trapped in their circumstances, that they're just wasting time and not fulfilling their potential, which they would be able to do if they had a more solid circumstance to live in.
This is Endless Line from the musical Shelter. Listeners, a sense of what this musical is. Lots of intricate harmonies. Can you talk about the songwriting part of this project? You wrote it with a brother-in-law.
Yes. Yes. I got lucky in my family connections, I guess you could say.
I mean, what did you say over Thanksgiving? Hey, I have an idea. Would you help me co-write some music? I mean, how does this work?
Actually, I think that might have been exactly how it happened, and it might have actually been Thanksgiving when we had our first conversation about it. Basically how it went was I had sat down and worked out an outline of the story with my husband. He's my story writing expert. And so we had that in mind. And then while I was training for a marathon that summer, this would have been 2 years ago, I guess, I would be writing songs in my head when I would get bored. And so I had most of the songs kind of written out in my head before I talked to Newell, my brother-in-law. And I asked him if he might be interested. He was studying composition at the U at the time. And he said yes. And so kind of how it would go is about 3 days a week, I would go to his apartment and get him out of bed and say, time to compose a musical now. he and I would just sit down with his keyboard and his computer, and I'd kind of sing it out for him and say, you know, from time to time I'd say, okay, so I'm kind of thinking the orchestration would go do 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 do, and then he would make music out of it. And it's been a great learning process for me. I've learned a lot about, you know, all those music theory type things you're probably supposed to know if you write a musical. But I would say probably how I would split up our process is I wrote the lyrics and the melodies and probably about half of the harmonies, and then Newell would kind of flesh it out with the orchestrations and cleaning up things and making sure they made sense musically.
Mm. What about the research of the subject matter? Did you spend some time in a women's shelter and talk to people about, you know, what a harrowing experience that can be?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, it's been such an amazing process of discovery for me. I mean, when we started writing about this, I really had no idea. I didn't know anything about homelessness. I didn't know anything about, I mean, I think I thought about homelessness what most people think, that it's just a bunch of panhandlers and, you know, people who are lazy or whatever it is, you know, I mean, or just people that you never really even think about. But I had the opportunity and have continued to have the opportunity to meet people and talk to people and tour shelters and hear people's stories. And it's been just so eye-opening about what homelessness really is and about the resources that are available and should be available to people who need them. So it's been really interesting.
We've only got about 30 seconds left, but Brighton, I want to play one snippet of another song, part of the solution. Set this up for us, if you would.
This comes towards the end of the show when Janine, who has left the shelter because of some harrowing experiences, makes a resolution to go back because her personal desire is to help solve the problem.
Brighton Sloan, director and producer of Shelter, Brittany Bullen, the writer and co-composer, and Shelter headed to New York City, an off-Broadway experience for the theater company in the 2012 New York Musical Theater Festival. Ladies, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
And good luck.
Thanks.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Lauren Hendrickson. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Tomorrow, it's Politics Up Close with Jeff Robinson. So join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.